Hölgyeim és uraim, kedves vendégeink, szeretettel köszöntöm Önöket a mai rendezvényünkön. Elsősorban szeretném tisztelettel köszönteni a budapesti Taiwani Képviseleti Iroda vezetőjét, Andrew Zhang urat, és munkatársát, Albert Zhang urat. Szeretném köszönteni a Taiwani Nemzeti Könyvtár igazgatóasszonyát, aki egyben a Taiwani Nemzeti Könyvtár Taiwan Történeti Kutatóintézetének is vezetője, professzor Zeng Shu Xian asszony, és munkatársát Kevin. Nagy szeretettel köszöntjük a mai előadónkat, Bo Zhui Zhen professzor úr. Természetesen nagyon szépen köszönjük a Keleti Gyűjtemény nevében is, hogy intézményünk főigazgatója a professzor dr. Monok István is körünkben van, és itt van. Először szeretném megkérni professzor Zeng asszony, hogy pár perces, rövid köszöntő beszédét mondja.
Director General Dr. Monok Estevan, Representative Andrew Zhang, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I'm very honored to visit Hungarian Academy of Sciences again, and delighted to see so many people join us today for the Taiwan Lecture on Chinese Study. Since 2012, the National Central Library has established Overseas Taiwan Resource Center for Chinese Studies to promote international exchanges and the resource sharing. The National Central Library does not only provide research resources and digital databases for our TRCCS partners, but also holds the Taiwan lectures on Chinese studies, as well as exhibitions from the library's rare books and special collections. Since last year, National Central Library has also started to organize academic conference with the TRCCS partners. All these efforts are made to build Taiwan Resource Center for Chinese Studies into a true platform for international scholarly exchanges and to showcase the prosperous and the diverse achievements of Taiwanese academia. The Taiwan Lectures on Chinese Studies allow Taiwanese scholars to visit our TRCCS partners to introduce their research, to make conversation with host scholars, and to seek opportunities for further cooperation. The lectures touch on a variety of topics, including traditional Chinese studies and Taiwan studies, digital humanities. Today's lecture is our first Taiwan lecture at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. After we established the Taiwan Resource Center for Chinese Studies here in May 2017. We are honored to have invited Professor Raisen Wu to be the speaker. Professor Wu is a research fellow of the Institute of Taiwan History of at Academic Seneca. His research specializes in the modern political and the intellectual history of Taiwan and Japan, with emphasis on themes such as nationalism, state formation, colonialism, post-colonial critique, and the left-wing movements. Professor Wu is not only a scholar, but also an activist. He had been involved in the social movements of Taiwan during the past decade that culminated in the outbreak of the Sunflower Movement of 2014. The topic of Professor Wu's speech is caught between empires, democracy and the nation state formation in Taiwan. I hope his talk will help you understand the political transitions Taiwan had traveled through. I believe it will also shed light on the development of democratic movement globally. Thank you. Thank you for your participation. Thank you very much.
Most pedig szeretném megkérni a professzor dr. Monok István főigazgató urat, hogy ő is tartsa meg köszöntő beszédét.
Director General Cheng, Your Excellency Professor Wu, it is my pleasure to greet you again in our library, and I am prepared to say two things. At first, to greet you, and I was prepared to present the activity of Professor Wu, but Director General Cheng is made still mad. I remember that in October, in 2016, we signed a memorandum of cooperation, and in May last year, we signed another agreement, which means high-quality scholarly research, primarily in the field of history, religion, culture, literature, and society. And in the last year, we became regularly the books, the scientific books from the National Library of Taiwan. And these books enriched our collection, Oriental collection, and I can see that it is in use, not only by the scholar of the Academy of Science, but also the scholars of the different universities, because the interest on Orient in Hungary grew up in the last years. So, and there is, like here you can see, a new young generation scholars with great and based interest. So this book, this exchange, serve a lot for the preparation of the experience before the travel. So, and I prepared, I read something, a curriculum on the net, the internet about Professor Wu, but before this the conference I had the opportunity to speak with him in 20 minutes, not more. So, and I am sure at first that we will have a great lecture. Second, we will have some studies, comparative, touched on the history of Hungary, because he is really open to ask and to search our history, and especially after this 20 minutes, we agreed that the Taiwan people and the Hungarian people has a lot similar on the national feeling and on this problematic. So we will hear about the Taiwan part, and I am sure that in this evening we will have the opportunity to speak, to enlarge our conversation at the table. So thank you for coming here, and please enjoy the lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I can use this one. Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to come to the beautiful city of Budapest. This is my first visit of this land of great artists and intellectuals. In fact, this is my first visit to Central Europe. When I was a high school boy, I came across the poetry of Bedelfi Sandor in both Chinese and English translations. And I was deeply touched by his passionate praise of love and liberty. The encounter then turned into a lifelong affection. Even though I have never learned to read the Hungarian language, I still try to get a hold of a book of collected poems by Bedelfi, this one. I think it's published by Helikon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's by Helikon Kiano. Yes. And I asked my friend to try to buy a copy for me, and I still cannot read it, but I put it on my bookshelf, and I look at it every day, as if I understand. Over the years, the poetry of Bedelfi, together with that of Heinrich Heine, has become the bridge that connected me with the European spirit of 1848. I'm very happy that I have finally come to the native land of Bedelfi. It is also a great honor to be able to come to the Hungarian Academy of Sciences and to share with you my distinguished scholars here, some of my reflections on the history of Taiwan, my motherland, or in Hungarian, my Hazar. However, some of you may wonder why a student of Taiwanese history should have come here as a speaker for a lectureship on Chinese studies. In fact, I am a political science, a PhD in political science, trained in the United States, and my special field include both Taiwan's political and intellectual histories and a comparative study of nationalism and colonialism, mainly focused on East Asia. Before that, I was, for a long time, a student of the Chicago School of Western Political Thought, founded by Leo Strauss. And I studied Jean-Jacques Rousseau's political thought for a long time. So why am I here? I don't really know the answer myself, but I guess it must have something to do with the name of the lectureship. The formal name of this lectureship, Taiwan Lectures on Chinese Studies, implies a subtle twist that might lead to the subversion of its original meaning. As a lectureship sponsored by Taiwan, that is, it is supposed to present a kind of Chinese studies with a Taiwanese perspective, or a kind of Chinese studies with the mediation of Taiwan, which in turn implies a likely change of the meaning, or a Taiwanization of the meaning, if you will, of the term Chinese studies. And this is exactly what I shall do here today, to present to you from a historical point of view how over time, through long-term social structural changes, the Chineseness of Taiwan in a political sense had come to be problematized, transform and eventually turn into a form of Taiwaneseness. In other words, what I'm going to present to you is a case of Chinese studies come Taiwan studies. Now I shall begin. The topic of my talk today is the following: Caught Between Empires, Democracy and Nation-State Formation in Taiwan. It goes with, let me begin with a question. What is Taiwan exactly? It goes without saying that my answer to this question has already been implied in the title itself. Namely, Taiwan is a state, or in a popular form of expression, Taiwan is a country, an independent country. If I already have an answer to my own question, then why would I bother even to raise the question, what is Taiwan in the first place? I have two reasons. One reason is that the protracted process through which Taiwan finally became a state constitutes an intellectually interesting as well as challenging question in itself to historians and social scientists. The other reason is that when it comes to international politics, realpolitik, the simple fact that Taiwan is a state or a country suddenly becomes something that cannot be said publicly and would create troubles for many if said publicly. In other words, the simple and plain fact that Taiwan is a state, a country, suddenly becomes an inconvenient truth, to borrow Al Gore's expression, when it comes to international politics. And an inconvenient truth always poses political and morally difficult questions. Today, I would like to share with you my reflections on the intellectual, political, and moral questions of Taiwan as a state. What is Taiwan? Taiwan is a state or an independent country. It possesses all the elements of a state, whether defined by political science and sociology or by international laws. It has a population of 23 million, a well-defined territory, a well-functioning government or a governing apparatus that monopolizes the means of legitimate violence, and also the capacity to enter into relations with other states. Here, I'm referring to Max Weber's classical definition of the state, as well as the definition of state in the Montevideo Convention on the Rights and Duties of the States of 1933. Moreover, Taiwan is not only a state, it is an emergent, a new nation state. The 23 million citizens of Taiwan have come to form a political community or a civic nation with a common identity and a common system of political and legal rights and obligations. Here, I'm certainly referring to the French idea of la nation, articulated by Rousseau, Abbé Sieyès, and Ernest Renan, rather than the German idea of die Nation, or folk, ethnic nation. Last but not least, Taiwan is a democratic nation state. Based on the principle of popular sovereignty, the citizens of Taiwan have been controlling the state through democratic institutions of self-government. The formation of Taiwan as a democratic nation state is not the outcome of the manipulation of any shrewd or evil politician such as Li Denghui, Chen Shui-bian, or Tsai Ing-wen. Rather, it is mostly an unintended consequence of long-term historical development and social structural changes. This is in fact a common sense in the disciplines of the study of history, sociology, and political science. And yet somehow, I still feel the need here to reiterate the common sense here. Why should I even bother to do this? Because it seems that the old common sense has been out of fashion and lost its validity at a time when a new superpower on the rise is trying very eagerly to redefine the reality. What I would like to share with you today is the story of how the people of Taiwan became a Taiwanese people and how the territory of Taiwan became a state. Like the stories of nation and state formation of all other countries, including that of Hungary, The Taiwanese case is a long story, and given the time constraint today, I cannot possibly go into all the details of this long and protracted process. In the following sections instead, I shall try to delineate a very schematic explanatory framework of Taiwan's nation-state formation in which democracy played a crucial role by using some conceptual tools in political science and historical sociology. I apologize deeply if you are not used to the concepts I shall be using today. I am, after all, not a real sinologist, but a political scientist. I'm sorry, Zheng Guanzhao, but I'm not really a real sinologist. Before I explain my framework, I would like to suggest three fundamental historical conditions that made the formation of Taiwanese people and Taiwanese state possible as the premise of my discussion. First, from the perspective of maritime history, or history of ocean, Taiwan had been since the prehistoric times an important traffic route for various peoples inhabiting or passing through East Asia, and was further brought upon the stage of world history by the power struggle between mercantilist European empires such as Spain, Portugal, and the Netherlands during the age of discovery of the 16th centuries. In the world, Taiwan or Formosa was an island with its own history before it entered the history of China. Let me show you some of the pictures, okay, some of the ancient pictures. This, the first one, the first picture is a picture, it's a map, I think it's drawn by a French mercenary of the Dutch Eastern Indian Company, Captain Ribben. He made a voyage to the East Indies in 1627. This is a map drawn by him in that time. You can see that Taiwan was on the route, okay? And also, let's move to the next, number two, yes. Okay, this is number two. Number two is a map drawn by a very famous Dutch cartographer, Willem Blauw, in 1635. You can see that also that Taiwan was very clearly on the map. And this is, they had a very clear vision of Taiwan as a route in the world, okay. And also the third one is also drawn by Willem Blauw sometime later in 1642 when the Netherlands acquired Taiwan as its colony. It's a map on Southeast Asia. Please look at the color of the, you know, the island of Taiwan just across the Strait of, across the Strait of China, mainland China. You can see that at that time, China wasn't really a part, Taiwan wasn't really a part of China. And then, so this is in the European mind and their ideal impression of Taiwan at the time. So you see, basically Taiwan had its own history before China acquired Taiwan. Secondly, the Qing Empire did not conquer and incorporate Taiwan until 1683. And during its 212-year rule of Taiwan, Beijing had adopted a policy of seabed, Haijin, toward Taiwan for more than 190 years. That is a policy that isolated Taiwan from the mainland and prohibited Chinese settlers from emigrating to Taiwan because they were afraid that Taiwan could become the base for rebellion, okay? So you see, a lot of our ancestors were actually illegal immigrants who smuggled themselves into Taiwan, okay? Also, the other kinds of ancestors that we have are pirates. So in here, the Taiwan is a land of illegal immigrants and also pirates, okay? Thirdly, during the period between 1895 and 1945, when Japan ruled Taiwan, and also the time is since 1949 till now, Taiwan had been and has been separated from mainland China and therefore underwent a separate trajectory of historical development. In a nutshell, it was under the objective historical conditions of long-term separation from China that Taiwan gradually treaded upon a distinct path of its own nation-state formation. Or to put it more, straightforwardly, Taiwan did not participate in the historical process of the formation of China as a modern nation state, especially the most crucial period of modern Chinese nationalism, the so-called long 20th century. Instead, Taiwan and China went separate ways during that period. This is the origin of the so-called Taiwan problem from the Chinese point of view, i.e. Taiwan was never part of the Chinese nation building during the 20th century. So from the Chinese point of view, Taiwan is an unfinished project for Chinese nationalism. And this was not any single person's fault, but an unintended outcome of historical contingencies. So you see, I'm not advocating a theory of conspiracy. I'm arguing that Taiwan's formation actually is an unintended outcome of historical contingencies. In the next section, I shall use the concept of society and state borrowed from social sciences to analyze the whole process of Taiwanese nation state formation from three levels. The first level is the society. That is the formation of the matrix or the prototype of a Taiwanese nation. And the second level is the state. That is the historical formation of Taiwan's state institutions. And the third level is the linkage of society and state through democratization in the 90s. Okay, so first, let's look at how the Taiwanese society was formed. We should understand that it's a basic understanding that Taiwan is a society formed predominantly by immigrants or settlers. Indigenous people only account for 2% of Taiwan's population now. And therefore, I shall focus on the indigenization and integration of various groups of immigrants or settlers that had come to Taiwan at different points of time since the 17th century and eventually They constituted the overwhelming majority of Taiwan's population. I divide the whole process of settlers' indigenization and integration into two long stages. The first stage is the period from Qing rule to the Japanese rule. And the second stage is the post-World War II era. Now let's examine the first stage. So what happened to Taiwan under the Qing rule? No doubt the indigenous peoples came to Taiwan long before Han settlers, but they have never formed any island-wide or even powerful regional state or regime in Taiwan. Therefore, one must look for the origin of the Taiwanese state not in the indigenous society, but in a society formed by the late-coming Han settlers. The Dutch first brought in Han settlers to Taiwan from southern China in the first half of the 17th century. But Taiwan had quickly become a society dominated by Han settlers in just a century. However, this settler society was for a long time in a state of fragmentation, if not total civil war. For the various settler groups formed on the basis of their ancestral places in southern China had persistently fought against each other in bitter and bloody armed struggle for scarce resources of land and water. Consider Taiwan as a colony, as a settlement colony for the Chinese settlers since the 17th and 18th century. And many different groups came to Taiwan as settlers, and they need water and land. And because of this, they fought and killed each other for water and land. For instance, the settlers from Zhangzhou, Fujian province, would fight fiercely with those from Quanzhou of the same province. But then settlers from southern Fujian or Minnan, including those from Zhangzhou and Quanzhou, commonly known as Hulu, would now band together and fight against Hakka from Canton. So this was so-called categorical or classified armed struggles. In Chinese, we call it 分类械斗, okay? Well known among students of Taiwanese history during the Qing rule. Literally, it means that the settlers classify or categorize themselves into various groups according to their birthplaces on the mainland, and then kill each other for land and water. This is the picture, drawn by some unknown painter. It's a story, it depicts a story about a very serious armed struggle between ethnic groups near in a suburb of Taipei City. Okay, and now this is one of the poetry, a long poem composed by a Taiwanese gentry scholar in mid 19th century. You see, just the first two lines. Zhangzhouren regarded Quanzhouren as donkeys, and Quanzhouren regarded Zhangzhouren as pigs. So of course, pigs and donkeys they kill each other. Okay. So this is a very, very vivid description of the kind of bitter hatred between different ethnic groups, okay? And it was not until 1860s, that is, until the Qing Empire had ruled Taiwan for over 180 years, that we began to witness the emergence of the first inklings of a common consciousness among various groups of Han settlers. Surely we cannot do surveys on the inhabitants of Taiwan of the 1860s. We cannot do gallops, because they are no longer there, to determine the condition of their identity. Nevertheless, a few significant events of social and cultural history at the time did shed some light on the condition of their identity. For instance, the first event was the indigenization of the categorical armed struggle among the settler groups. The settlers did not stop fighting each other during the 1860s. They kept fighting, and actually they kept fighting each other until the early 1900s. But the basis on which they formed their groups changed from the ancestral places on the mainland to their settlement places in Taiwan. Interesting. They still fought each other, and they even kill each other. But now they no longer fought as Zhangzhouren against Quanzhou people, or as Hulu against Hakka. But now they fought or kill each other as natives of different villages or townships of Taiwan, such as Shilin versus Tansui, or Mengjia versus Shilin, or Taipei versus Yilan. This was an insight of a great Taiwanese anthropologist, Professor Chen Qinan. He raised a point in his very influential book on the Chinese society in Taiwan, under the Qing rule. Okay, I'm sorry, I couldn't find a larger picture. Okay, so the second event was the formation of a bilingual Confucian gentry class under the examination that crossed ethnic boundaries. One of the earliest Taiwanese intellectuals who have won the highest degree of Qing examination, Ke Qizhi, the highest degree is called Jin Shi. And the guy who actually won, the first guy to won, to have won the high degree, Jin Shi, was a person named Zheng Yongxi from Xinzhu area. He composed a famous text around the same time, 1850s, titled Unreconciliation, Quan He Lun, in 1853, with a view to persuading various settlers groups in Taipei area to stop fighting each other by pleading to the simple fact that aren't we all Taiwanese now, after we already immigrated from the mainland. In Chinese, I'm sorry, pardon for me for speaking Chinese, 然同自内地不迁而来，则同为台人而已. Okay, so this is the earliest picture that I can find of this Zheng Yongxi. He looked terrible, and maybe it's a problem of the technology of photography, I'm sorry, but this is early. I found this in a book, you know, compiled by a Japanese anthropologist in the 1920s. Okay, I couldn't find any image of the text, so you know I can only say it verbally. I'm sorry. The emergence of this curious text, which was perhaps the first in Taiwan's intellectual history that tried to articulate a notion of we, the Taiwanese, during this period, provided an indirect but powerful evidence to the formation of a local elite class with common language, which is classical Chinese, and a common Confucian upbringing. We might call this a formation of an ideological basis of a common identity as Taiwanese. By the way, the formation of a bilingual, you want to put this? Okay, the second one. So this is the house of Zheng Yongxi. It's still there, and it become a very prestigious residence, and it's still pronounced as kind of a historical site in Taiwan. Jin Shi Di means the house of Jin Shi, okay. Okay, by the way, the formation of a bilingual gentry class in Taiwan in the 1860s reminds one of the kind of bilingual colonial elite that later became the first generation of colonial nationalists described by Benedict Anderson in his The Imagined Communities. Of course, the Taiwanese bilingual elite that emerged in the late Qing period was only a prototype of Taiwanese nationalists that would come two generations later under the Japanese rule. I will tell the story later, in a minute. And the third event was the formation of a common economic interest between Holo and Hakka, the two different, you know, main ethnic groups in Taiwan who fought each other. Due to the prospering camphor trade in the 1860s, this one should be easy to understand. They used to kill each other, you know, just for water and land, but now they work together to make money from the new camphor trade. Yeah, in addition to the common ideology, now a material basis for common identity also came into being. This is the insight of a historian, Lin Manhong, Professor Lin Manhong. Also, she worked in the Modern History Institute of Academia Sinica. And that was her book. And then this one is this one, Taiwanese workers cutting down camphor trees. And let's see the next one. This one is, these are Hakka people in central Taiwan. They are trying to distill camphor from the camphor tree. The Minnan people, Holo people, you know, because they are richer, they came to Taiwan earlier and occupied the richest land in Taiwan, so they became richest. That's why they provided the capital. And then Hakka people, they came to Taiwan a little bit later, so they were forced to leave, you know, by the mountain. But accidentally, they control, you know, camphor tree. So So you see, that's why they somehow, before they used to fight each other, now because of this common interest, they began to collaborate, to cooperate with each other. So so the Minnan people provide the capital, and then the Hakka people provide the materials. And all together they make a lot of money. And then somehow they became good friends. And then they became a family. Okay. So taken together, the three above mentioned indicators to suggest or prove indirectly that an initial form of common identity as Taiwanese was emerging at least among the elite strata of the Han settlers during the 1860s. It takes further study to examine and determine whether those indigenous peoples who were being increasingly sinicized, the so-called cooked barbarians of a Pingpu, whether they participate in the process of formation of a Taiwanese identity, we don't know. However, there's no doubt that those assimilated indigenous peoples, commonly known as raw materials, Sheng Fan, the ancestors of what we call the indigenous peoples now, were totally outside the category of Taiwanese at the time due to Qing dynasty's isolation policy. So you see, this has been the picture of Taiwan under the Qing rule. Defeated by the rising Japanese Empire in 1894, the crumbling old empire of Qing signed the Treaty of Shimonoseki in 1895 and handed Taiwan to a modernizing Japanese state. So what then happened to Taiwan under the Japanese rule? But before I go into the Japanese rule, you know, I want to say a few words, because I think the director of the library, he told me that we Hungarians lost all the wars, right? Mm. Yeah, okay, this is exactly what happened to Taiwan. So actually we are not, you know, we are very familiar with the kind of feeling, okay? We never won, okay? We always lost, and we became, you know, the pawns of superpowers. Now let's go to the Japanese period. The rule of Japan's Meiji state was the first encounter with what the social scientists would call the modern state on the part of Taiwanese people. The crucial characteristic of a modern state is direct rule. That is the kind of rule by which the state power penetrates to the bottom of the society and reaches to all corners of the society, thereby shaping the rule into royal citizens or subjects. In contrast, the Qing Empire was a pre-modern agrarian bureaucratic empire whose reach of the state was limited to the level of the county, Xian, okay? So beneath the county, you know, basically the society was self-governing, is under Qing state. But this is not the case under the Japanese rule, because the Japanese state was the first state to penetrate to the bottom of the society and to control the whole society. By and large, the 51 years of Japanese rule of Taiwan produced highly conflicting, if not totally contradictory, political outcomes in Taiwan. On the one hand, Japan managed to integrate Taiwan into a community, or in German, we call it a Gemeinschaft, in economic, social, and cultural senses through various infrastructural as well as ideological social engineering projects. During the 51 years, for instance, the government general of Taiwan, that is the Japanese colonial state imposed in Taiwan, not only completed an island-wide transportation network, but also turned the island into an integrated, self-sufficient, and prospering capitalist economy. This is the picture of Japan completed the first railway network, island-wide railway network in 1908. And this is the picture, this is a map of how the Japanese completion of the island-wide highway network, but it wasn't completed until 1945. And let's see the next one. This is the picture of the Bank of Taiwan. It's the headquarters of capitalism in Taiwan. So it was founded by Japanese, okay. And this is a map of, you know, the Japanese survey of all the forestry and the mountain and all the lands of Taiwan. They finished this process in 1915, which paved way for, you know, for the capitalist development of Taiwan. It's a very important is a very important step, because, you know, under the Qing rule, because Qing state was very weak, Qing was never able to control, to manage, to understand how many people they are actually governing and how much land they have, because of the weakness of the state power. But somehow Japan was the first state to penetrate and to actually control and to know exactly how many people are there in Taiwan and how much land they have, including mountains, forestry, and oceans. Okay, and okay, sorry. Moreover, it also managed to turn the Javanese language into the common language of this new Gemeinschaft through aggressive and effective assimilation policies. Perhaps the most effective among colonial empires that adopted assimilationist policy at the time. At the time, in the time during before World War II, basically three major colonial empires advocated very aggressive assimilationist policy, which was French Empire, the Portuguese Empire, and then the Japanese Empire. But it took like 150 years for the French to assimilate the Algerian, only 10%. But Japan managed to assimilate 75% of Taiwanese into speaking Japanese in 51 years. So it's very effective. Okay. And up until 1930s, an island-wide community of reading had come into being, and more Taiwanese writers began to write in Japanese. Let's look at some pictures. This is a magazine published in Tokyo by Taiwanese students called Formosa. Actually, it was a nationalist magazine, but somehow it was written in Japanese. But it's not so strange because, you know, William Butler Yeats wrote in English against English, right? Let's look at the next one. Okay, this one, and also the next one. Okay, these are all very famous short stories written in Japanese by Taiwanese writers during that period, and they all won major prizes, literary prizes in Tokyo. So you are saying, this is what I wanted to make. The point I want to make is that at the time, basically, Taiwanese people are turning into a Japanese-speaking people because of this very aggressive assimilation policy. Okay. By 1942, about 75% of Taiwanese people had come to know the Japanese language very well. As a whole, in other words, the Japanese rule of Taiwan not only sped up, but eventually completed the social integration that had begun under the Qing rule. But this is only one part of one side of the story. On the other hand, however, Japan's colonial and institutional discrimination against the Taiwanese people inadvertently politicized the new Gemeinschaft that they created in the first place, thereby transforming it into the prototype of a Taiwanese nation. Of course, Japanese did a lot of good things in Taiwan, and they did a lot of construction. But let's not forget the simple fact that Japanese rule was basically a colonial rule, which was characterized by discrimination. So you see, it was on the aforementioned basis of both integration and discrimination that we witnessed the rise of the first wave of modern Taiwanese nationalism in 1920s that consciously pursued Taiwanese national self-determination as well as a distinct national cultural identity. Okay, so you see, this is the first issue of the first Taiwanese first magazine of Taiwanese nationalism. It was published in 1990 by the Taiwanese students in Tokyo. And also it was written partially by Japanese and partially by classical Chinese. And also the publication of this magazine signified the birth of Taiwanese nationalism. And also, let's see the next one. The Taiwan Cultural Association, Taiwan Wenhua Xiehui, it was founded in 1921, was the early political form of this wave of Taiwanese nationalism. So this is the picture of the foundation of the early Taiwanese nationalist organization. This early nationalist movement created an early discourse of a self-determining Taiwanese people with its distinct national culture, as well as various related notions of Taiwaneseness in linguistics, folklore, literature, and even philosophy. We have a scholar trained, we have a philosopher trained in Tokyo University, trained in the kind of Hegelian philosophy in Tokyo University, actually he came to write a kind of a philosophical treatise on the phenomenology of Taiwanese. Okay. Okay, so this is a very interesting magazine published in the 30s. The title is Nanyin, it's called The Voice or The Sound of the South. I mean, literally, it means that we have to create a Taiwanese language in its written forms. So, and they call this kind of language Taiwan Huawen, is, you know, like, you know, in contrast to the Chinese, the vernacular Chinese, usually called Bai Huawen, which means the written form of vernacular Taiwanese. Okay, so they meant it to be the prototype of a future Taiwanese national language. So it was like an experimentation. Okay, so as a movement, it reached its peak in early 1930s, but was quickly cracked down and crushed by the Japanese government right after the outbreak of a Sino-Japanese war in 1937. During the last decade of the Japanese rule, Taiwan was increasingly assimilated and incorporated into the Japanese national body under a tremendous pressure of wartime mobilization, like Okinawa half a century ago. At the end of World War II, Taiwan was very similar to the situation of Okinawa, highly assimilated, highly Japanized, and very, very few people knew how to speak Mandarin or Chinese. So this is let's take a look at some of the, you know, this is the news about a very aggressive linguistic assimilation policy. So you see, 国语普及, meaning of how to spread the policy, the official policy to spread the national language. By national language, they mean Japanese language, of course, and it's actually sponsored and advocated by the colonial government. Okay, next one. Okay, I'm sorry for this, the small size, but here, look at this. This is a certificate to recognize that, okay, if your family, all your family members can speak fluent Japanese, then you will be given a certificate proving that you guys are like, you know, a family of national language, kokugo kate. Okay. Actually, my family was this kind of assimilated family. And this is a very typical Taiwanese dressing, you know, dressed like Japanese. This is a very regular, you know, phenomenon during the late colonial period. You will see more and more Taiwanese assimilated and Japanese. Okay. So this is what the KMT encountered in 1945 when they came to Taiwan. So no wonder they were very surprised that, you know, actually they came to Taiwan. They thought that Taiwan was China territory actually, but they came to a Japanese land. Okay, this is because after 51 years of very aggressive assimilationist policy, Taiwan had already been largely Japanized. And this is a picture of Taiwanese being conscripted by the Japanese government. So you see Taiwanese dressed as Japanese soldier. And so the family there were celebrating their conscription, okay? And this actually is part of the memory of, you know, the previous generation of Taiwanese. So for them, the wartime memories are very complicated, has a very complicated moral meaning. On the one hand, they were conscripted, they were forced to fight, to kill in the war. But on the other hand, that's their youth, that's their own memory, okay? So when, if Hungarians had a dual mentality of being perpetrator and victim at the same time, then Taiwanese too. We have a similar situation. We were being drafted to fight for Japan. But in the meantime, we were forced to fight. Okay. So, well, anyway, this is the story of the Japanese rule, okay? So if history continued, then, you know, Taiwan now will be the second Okinawa. And you will come to a land, for instance, if you come to Taiwan, as part of Japan, you will find a land which is Japan and at the same time is not Japan. If you go to Okinawa, you get this feeling. This is Japan, but yet this is not Japan. So this would, you know, would happen to Taiwan if Taiwan had been governed by Japan. But anyway, the process through which Taiwan was gradually incorporated into the Japanese state was terminated abruptly when Japan was defeated in 1945. as if the history were repeating its mischief. Another wave of political refugees or settlers from China arrived at Taiwan after the end of World War II. With over 1 million of new settlers, commonly known as the mainlanders, fleeing to the island, Taiwan was confronted with yet another difficult or protracted process of conflict and amalgamation between ethnic groups, this time mostly between the indigenized earlier settlers and aboriginal peoples, or the so-called native Taiwanese on the one hand, and the newly arrived mainlanders on the other. In fact, the whole process constitutes a significant part of Taiwan's post-war history that began with the outbreak of the tragic 228 incident in 1947 and the long martial law rule, and eventually ended with the democratization in the 1990s. Again, I cannot go into too many details here due to the time constraint. It is sufficient to say that the conflicts and integration among ethnic groups in the post-World War II era also proceeded largely according to the same logic of the formation of a settler society. Please keep in mind that Taiwan did not really have such an ancient history like Hungary. Taiwan is a relatively new country, formed by settlers. Yeah. Okay, so what's the logic of it, the formation of a settler society, that is, the indigenization of settlers and the integration of ethnic groups that earlier period had experienced? In other words, after World War II, the once indigenized and integrated Taiwanese society had to undergo another process where new settlers from without became natives, an ethnic group that hate each other, again, learn to reconcile between themselves. So it took very, very long time. Simply put, it would take another half a century before the newly arrived mainlander group, who were politically dominant and emotionally very much attached to China, began to show some signs of indigenization as well as integration into the Taiwanese society. During the wave of democratization in the 90s, some first and second generation mainlanders came forward to identify themselves as Taiwanese and support Taiwanese independence openly. Please, to the next. Yeah, this is the one of the organization called the Association of Mainlanders for Taiwan Independence. Okay, this and at the center was the founder of the organization. Is actually, he was a veteran of the KMT troops, Professor Liao Zhongshan, and somehow, you know, he decided to abandon his Chinese identity and to claim himself to be a Taiwanese, and then he founded this group. This is what happened in the 90s. And this was a historic break with the dominant Chinese identity of most mainlanders, but one had to wait another 20 years, that is to wait until 2010s to see in the wave after wave of civic activism, the emergence of a whole new generation of so-called natural-born Taiwanese independence supporters, many of whom came from the third or the fourth generation mainlanders' families. Yeah. So this is the Chinese called 天然独, meaning natural-born independence supporters. Okay, many of them were from the third or fourth generation mainlanders, and this one. Okay, so this is one of the a very interesting picture here. I stand for Taiwan's independence, and many of the young people, those young people, you know, in the social movement during the past decades, you know, and they like to wear this kind of t-shirt, and many of them from the mainlander family. Okay, so I'm taking this as a sociological phenomenon. You know, you have to we have to understand the formation of a nation state. It's of course political, but political as well as sociological. You know, I wanted to emphasize the sociological side of the phenomenon. After almost 70 years since the they first arrived in Taiwan, the mainlanders finally made a big step forward in becoming native and Taiwanese. As the great poet T.S. Eliot said in his famous Four Quartets, only the passing of time can overcome time. It takes time for a nation state to be formed, anyway. Before I discuss the state institutions in Taiwan, I should add one note to the post-war history of Taiwan. We need to remember that the formation of a settler society always involves bitter and oftentimes bloody conflicts. The post-war history of Taiwan began with a bloody conflict between the local society and the newly arrived suzerain power, that is the Republic of China ruled by Chiang Kai-shek and his KMT in Nanjing. This was the famous 228 incident of 1947, where an island-wide revolt against the Chinese misrule was mercilessly suppressed and tens of thousands of Taiwanese people, many of them elite or young people, were massacred, please. This is one of a very rare picture left about the 228 incident of 1947. This is where the Taiwanese people began to surround the monopoly bureau, and then the troops were beginning to shoot at the people. And this is a famous painting, you know, wood painting describing depicting how the KMT troops, you know, shooting the Taiwanese people. Taiwanese people during the incident, okay? And the picture there on the right corner is the author, is the painter who made this paint. And then he was actually arrested and killed right after the incident. Okay? And this is one of the very most famous Taiwanese painters. And he was killed too in the incident. And this is the picture of his body, Chen Chenghuo. And he was influenced by Impressionism. Well, you see, Taiwan is a young nation, so everything came or emerged late. We are not as cultured and civilized as you guys here, okay? Mm-hmm. But we learned. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the most famous first generation modern painters. And at the time, he was the city councilman of Jiayi, of southern Taiwan. And he went together with other city councilmen to negotiate with the KMT troops. But somehow he was arrested, and he never, and he returned the body, the dead body, and then somehow the picture was released 20 years ago. Okay, please. So, okay, thank you. Out of this conflict emerged a new wave of Taiwanese nationalism, this time in quest of Taiwan's independence from China, either from the White China, KMT, or the Red China, CCP. Let's see the following, yes. Okay, so this guy was the president of the provisional government of the Republic of Taiwan. It's an exile government in Tokyo. And his name is Thomas Liao. He's the first engineer, PhD in engineering. He got his PhD from Ohio State. And then he married two American lawyers. So he's one of the early modernists in Taiwan. And anyway, after the 228, he fled to Japan, and he formed an exile movement called a provisional government of Republic of Taiwan. Okay, and that behind him was the national flag. Okay, and this is the second generation of very famous Taiwanese linguist in Japan, at the center, Wang Yude, and his students. They form another group called Taiwan Youth. This is the second generation of exile in Japan, and then the next. Okay, I'm sorry for the small size. This is the first Taiwanese Marxist historian. He wrote this, you know, the 400-year Taiwanese history from, you know, a Marxist point of view. He's not as great as George Lukács, but he's all we have, okay? And he's still living. He's still alive. He's like over 100 years. Yeah. Okay. And born as an exile movement, this wave of post-war Taiwanese nationalism gradually merged with the rising democratic movement inside Taiwan during the 1980s. Let's look at it. Okay, this is within Taiwan after 228. So Taiwan's, how should I say that, the social force of Taiwan revived gradually. So in the 50s, we witnessed the emergence of the first local democratic movement. This was some of the legislators at the time, very famous for fighting for the voice of Taiwanese. I think the picture was taken in the 50s. Okay, and this were the second generation, the 70s. Both were lawyers. They began as lawyers, and then they joined a democratic movement in the 70s and became two of the most famous leaders of the democratic movement in the 70s, which actually formed, out of the movement born, the current DPP, Democratic Progressive Party. And this is the most famous magazine called the Formosa magazine. And I think they took the picture in 79, I think. And they published, at the time, you know, the magazine served as a sort of quasi-opposition party against the KMT, because KMT forbade the formation of any opposition parties. So they used the organ of the magazine as, you know, as a quasi-party and to organize around the island. Okay. So we have discussed how the Taiwanese society, that is the matrix of a Taiwanese nation, was formed. Now let's move to the state. My discussion will be mostly conceptual, therefore very brief and schematic. But I'm very tired. Can I take a break? I'm sorry. I'll just... I'm actually bored by my own talk. I'm sorry. Okay. It's okay. Now let's go to this very boring part. I'll be very quick. Okay. Let's talk about how the state. We already seen how the Taiwanese society is formed. And now let's go to the topic of the state. There's a very influential research approach in contemporary political science and sociology called historical institutionalism, which argues that all institutions, including state institutions, are formed over long periods of time and thus must be understood and explained historically. One of the crucial concepts or insights suggested by historical institutionalism is the idea of historic institutional accumulation, which means that all institutions are formed through accumulation of rulemaking practice and revisions over long periods of time. As a political scientist, I had found this concept rather useful in understanding the state formation in Taiwan. Seen from the perspective of regime, Taiwan's political history was quite, you know, fragmented and discontinuous, since the island had been ruled by consecutive and mutually conflicting colonial regimes since the 17th century. However, you would be able to observe some continuity of the same history out of accumulation of institutions over time, if you look at it from the viewpoint of historical institutionalism. For instance, the Dutchman. The Dutch, who established the first colonial rule in Taiwan in the first half of the 17th century, they invented in Taiwan a pre-modern and feudal form of state land ownership called the King's Land, Wang Tianzi. The system by which they managed to appropriate in the name of the king lots of arable land originally tilled by the indigenous peoples. This system of state land ownership was inherited with slightly altered form by the Koxinya, the Zheng Chengong regime, and the Qing Empire that ruled the island successively after the Dutch left. As the first regime that succeeded in incorporating the whole territory of Taiwan under its jurisdiction, Japan expanded and transformed this feudal land system into a modern form of state land ownership. Eventually, the KMT regime after World War II directly inherited the entire Japanese land system. In fact, it was Japan that introduced and built in Taiwan a whole set of government institutions with an overdeveloped administrative branch characteristic of a modern colonial state. The KMT, despite its anti-Japan ideology, practically inherited in wholesale, in its entirety, the colonial state institutions, such as household register system, monopoly system, public education, public health, transportation, local administration, and even the police. Japanese created the police and then the KMT inherited the police, okay? So the institutional continuity between the KMT state and the Japanese colonial state in Taiwan was spectacular and unmistakable. Of course, the KMT regime made its own contributions to Taiwan's accumulated state formation. Above all, it brought to Taiwan the entire institutional form of an independent sovereign state, the Republic of China, as well as its key personnel, including the military. After the outbreak of Korean War in 1950, this emigre or exile Republic of China, imposed from without on the territory of Taiwan, became a new independent state under the protection, let's make it clear, under the protection of the United States. A historian called this state, born of Cold War, an accidental state. Accidental state. And the other historian called Chiang Kai-shek, the accidental founding father of this accidental state.
Next one.
Yeah, you see.
This is a Chinese translation,
I'll say. So accidental it may have been, but isn't history always full of accidents and contingencies? All the institutional accumulations from the Dutch rule to the post-war KMT rule that I described occur within the boundaries of Taiwan. Over time, over a long time, the institutional accumulated process turned Taiwan from an island colony into a territorial state, commonly known as the Republic of China on Taiwan. Okay, so let's move to how the society and state was finally linked. The Republic of China on Taiwan was an independent sovereign state, but it was not yet a nation state because it was a state without nation. It was a state without nation when it was founded in Taiwan. First, as an authoritarian state imposed from without, it did not have anything to do with the local society to begin with. Second, the newly arrived mainlanders were not yet integrated into the local society. They were inhabitants composed by various ethnic groups, but this inhabitant did not form a community or a nation. Eventually, the key that linked the state and the society and turned the inhabitants into a civic nation was democratization. However, this process was a bit too complicated again and to discuss in detail. Still, the logic is simple and clear. In short, by including the majority of citizens long deprived or excluded from political rights into decision-making process of the state through the mechanism of political participation, the state from without, the state from, you know, imposed from without, suddenly became my state, my own country. In the meantime, democratization necessarily meant the Taiwanization of the state, not only because the state was territorially congruent with the territory of Taiwan, but also because the indigenized earlier settlers, i.e. the native Taiwanese, accounted for the overwhelming majority of the population. So let me sum up here. The three historical processes of settler indigenization, social integration, and the accumulated formation of state institutions converge with the democratization of the 1990s, which further deepened in the subsequent years, eventually resulting in the contemporary form of the Taiwanese state. Taiwanese people inherited the Republic of China and then transformed it into a democratic state of their own. Nonetheless, the consolidation of democracy takes time. Taiwan's democratization began in the early 90s. But democracy in Taiwan was not consolidated until recently, after we experienced 6 presidential elections and 3 times of regime change. Along with the process of democratization and democratic consolidation, the indigenization of the mainlanders have been progressing too. In the Sunflower Movement, the Sunflower Student Movement 2014, and the Anti-Black Box Curriculum Movement of 2015, mostly led by high school students, we witnessed numerous pro-independent student activists who were third generation or fourth generation mainlanders. Let's look at some interesting pictures.
This is the Sunflower Movement, you know, the movement where the student activists, they occupy Taiwan's Congress for like 3 weeks, I think more than 3 weeks, because they were opposed to the congressional approval of the signing of the service and trade agreement between Taiwan and China, because they were afraid that by signing this treaty that Taiwan would be economically absorbed into China. Okay, and then they storm into, on the moment when the KMT passed the legislation, the student, they storm into the parliament and then occupy, you know, the parliament, and then they stay there for, this is the 53rd hour of their occupation. Okay, and they took a picture. Okay, let's see, so this is the 63rd hours, okay. So you can see the Chinese there, and the English there, okay. And this is, you know, during, I think, well into the second week of the demonstration, the occupation, they found that, you know, that the movement was losing the momentum. So some activists, you know, they decided to occupy another building. In Taiwan, we have prime minister and also have Congress, right? So they occupy the Congress, but now some of them decided to occupy the administrative branch of the government, which is legislative, is the office for the Taiwanese prime minister. And then they went there and occupied. This is student, they jump over the fence and went into another place and occupy the part of there. Okay, and then of course this time, the government reacted with riot police. So this is the riot police action. They are spraying water to the students. Okay. And this is the on the eve before they left. This is the height, sort of the peak. The combination of the whole movement is on March the 13th, where half a million of Taiwanese citizens took to the street and occupied. This is only one corner. Okay, basically during that day, half a million of Taiwanese citizens took to the street, and everybody wear black. That's why I wrote an article called "On the Black Tide." Yeah, because they, black symbolized anti-power, symbolized opposition to power. Okay, so let's see the next one. So this is the new movement the following year. You can see as extension of the original movement, this time led by high school students. They were, again, because a policy by the KMD government wanted to revise the guidelines of high school historical education. They want to impose an orthodox Chinese nationalist, historical curriculum. And the students, they didn't want it, they're opposed to that. Instead of a Chinese nationalist historiography, they wanted a Taiwan-centered history education. So they reacted, and then they said that it's a black box decision, so they were against that. And they, okay, see the next one. Okay, so this high school student, they were radicalized by the previous movement. So you see, they were like in the, this high school student, maybe between 15 and 18, okay, they jump over the fence. And you see that, the word, the Chinese character, this is Ministry of Education. They jump over the fence, it's an occupation syndrome. Everybody wants to occupy a government building, okay. Now, high school student, they want to occupy a government building too, okay, so then they jump over the building fence. Okay, and so, okay, this is also, okay, and then they occupy the plaza there. And there, they began to negotiate with the Ministry of Education. And this is Lin Guanghua, he's a high school boy, and he killed himself in protest to the policy. So you see, the movement got very radicalized and violent. Eventually, of course, they successfully stopped the policy. Okay. Okay. This kind of picture, this kind of landscape, were completely unimaginable in the 1990s. And many of the student activists from these two movements, they were from mainland families. I personally met tons of them. They came to me and complaining to me that they cannot see anything eye to eye with their parents because the parents identify with China and they identify themselves as Taiwanese. So you see, we witness a kind of generational shift of identity. Okay, and this is totally unimaginable in the 90s. Therefore, we may well judge from this fact that the indigenization of the mainland group has been largely, a large advance. In sum, it should be safe to argue that after 20-some years of democratization and democratic consolidation of a Taiwanese nation in the civic sense and the Taiwanese national identity shared by the Taiwanese citizens were finally born. In other words, democratization was the final and most crucial stage of phase of Taiwan's nation state formation. Finally, the conclusion. Please bear with me for a few more minutes. Okay, I'll soon be over. So we can identify a few characteristics of the history of Taiwan's nation state formation that I just described. The first one is that, simply put, Taiwan is a case of state formation that took place at a very special space, a political space of what Stein Rokine, a political scientist from Holland, he called this interface. A small country, a small piece of territory caught between two superpowers or two strong countries. Well, Hungary, Hungarians understand this, interface. Okay, so Taiwan is a case of a state formation at the interface between multiple empires or geopolitical centers. In other words, the state of Taiwan was formed in a geopolitical position of being caught between empires. It was this very special geopolitical situation that brought about the phenomenon of successive and multi-layered colonialism, that is the rule of successive colonial regimes imposed by different centers and the hierarchical structure of domination between various ethnic groups, which were very characteristic of Taiwan's history. Therefore, the main task of state formation in Taiwan was to overcome, always, to overcome the political and social division originated from Taiwan's unfortunate geopolitical position. The second thing, the leitmotif that will recur throughout the 400 years history of Taiwan's formation can be summarized as follows. First, you see the late coming groups, they would dominate the earlier ones. And then such domination would give rise to conflicts between late coming and earlier coming groups. Finally, after a long period of conflicts, they would somehow reach a conciliation, but only after a very difficult process. And after the cycle was finally completed, and because of the joke of the geopolitical powers, and suddenly a new similar cycle would have to happen again. And the third thing is, from the perspective of state and society, the history of Taiwan's formation was a process of transition from the confrontation between state and society into the confrontation, a kind of a reconciliation and eventual linking of connection between the state and society. Overall, the history of the formation of Taiwan was not a rosy and beautiful fairy tale. Far from it. In fact, it has been a long and cruel history where outsiders struggle to become natives and enemies struggle to become friends under very extremely difficult and unfavorable geopolitical conditions. First, we have to wait until various groups to begin to indigenize and to see themselves as Taiwanese. Then we also needed to democratize the regime and to rebuild a more reasonable relationship between ethnic groups and between the state and society. In other words, we need to decolonize unequal relationship between ethnic groups and to control the state by the popular will. In Taiwan, the relation between state and society was very unfair. It's more like a colonial for a long time. And also the relationship between different ethnic groups were unequal. As I said, latecomers came to dominate earlier comers. So you see, we have like vertical and horizontal colonial relationship in Taiwan, which basically divided and fragmented the whole society. Before it can be overcome, there's no nation state. And somehow we have to wait for until all this is overcome. And it was not until we finally did all these difficult jobs that the social conflict and state violence that had long haunted Taiwanese history finally began to disappear. And the society began to become united. And the Taiwanese national identity began to consolidate. At any rate, it should be fair to say that at least from a domestic point of view, the formation of Taiwan as a democratic nation state is highly unlikely to be reversed. However, seen from an external perspective, Taiwan's unfortunate political or geopolitical situation of being caught between empires has remained as difficult as ever. No, perhaps it has become worse and more dangerous than ever. The main reason was, of course, the rapid rise and expansion of a new empire, or the revival of an old empire in East Asia, namely China. Especially China's increasingly aggressive diplomatic besiege, military harassment, and geo-economic invasion of Taiwan in recent years has posed a serious challenge to the stability and security of the nascent state of Taiwan. In fact, the heightened pressures from China are now creating new fissures, if not divisions, within Taiwan, and some citizens are, as of now, beginning to move to a more realistic and even submissive stance toward the almighty Chinese Empire. Moreover, the structural conflict between the two contending imperial powers, the US and China, has become more and more intense, and thus is more and more likely to involve Taiwan in the conflict in near future, or perhaps Taiwan has already been involved in this dangerous conflict. Let's look at Taiwan's geopolitical situation. Time passes, but the geopolitical situation can change. It remains the same, okay? So this is China, you see. We see the rise of China, and it's not only an ancient sense of China, in an ancient form of empire. It's become a new form of empire in a very classical Marxist sense, in the sense that it's exporting its capital. So you see, according to Marx's definition of empire, empire basically is driven by the exploitation of capital, domestic capital, right? So you see, on the one hand, we see one road and one belt. This is a new vision of Chinese and the domination and the new world order. See the next one. So you see, this is a very significant gesture between Xi Jinping and Aung San Suu Kyi. Okay, so Xi Jinping is trying to, he has already changed one of the most loved piece, well, anyway, heroines in human rights, right? And now he's trying to create a new world order in China's image. On the other hand, we have a different vision of a new strategy of containment caused by Donald Trump. He had this idea of Indo-Pacific region, you can see. This is a basic strategy against Chinese expansion. It's a new containment. See the next. And these four guys, okay, Donald Trump and Modi, and this is the Australian Prime Minister, and then Abe Shinzo of Japan. They call this Quad. Okay, these four leaders of the major powers, they met, you know, they had this agreement to form a new strategic bloc to contain the expansion of China in this area. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So you see, there's no way for Taiwan to escape. Okay, whether you have to, well, you have to surrender to China or you have to join the United States. And the fact is, maybe Taiwan is being dragged into this, you know, Indo-Pacific camp. And I'm saying this as a fact without any moral judgment, okay? And to put it in a different way, just when the Taiwanese people finally overcame the internal division caused by its geopolitical situation and managed to build a nation state of its, their own, the same geopolitical condition immediately posed serious new threats to the solidarity and independence of this new nation and new state. 24 years ago, you want this one? 24 years ago, 24 years ago, President Li Denghui of the newly democratized Taiwan at the time said to the famous Japanese novelist Shiba Ryotaro, quoting the concept of Nishita Kitaro, the great philosopher of Kyoto school philosophy, that being born as a Taiwanese was a sorrow of place, namely a sorrow of being born in the wrong place where one cannot be free to be oneself. So this is a picture of Li Denghui paying homage to, you know, Shiba Ryotaro, who already passed away a few years ago. They had this conversation in 24 years ago, and he was a very, at the time, you know, I was very young at the time, but I was deeply struck by the profound but very sad words of our philosopher king, Li Denghui, and have been thinking about the same question to this day, when I'm already a middle-aged college professor. And the situation has not changed. Now you may ask, is this the fact of being born in the totally contingent but completely unfortunate place between the empires the permanent and the unshakable curse of the Taiwanese people and the democratic country that they had fought so hard to build? This is a question I asked myself. And then my answer is that I don't think so. For history has proven repeatedly that the Taiwanese people did manage to overcome the curse of geopolitical constraints, that is, the curse of being born in the wrong place, with their will, determination, and hard efforts. First of all, it took the Taiwanese people nearly 100 years to finally build a democratic state in narrow space between the empires. It was next to a Mission Impossible, but somehow we did it. Secondly, when the new empire rose roughly in 2000s to besiege and invade Taiwan, the Taiwanese people, especially the younger generation of Taiwanese, rose up again to break the siege. The attack of the empire, change the geopolitical balance of power, and save their country. This was the story of the Sunflower Movement of 2014. Let's look at this picture again. I am not trying to be sentimental, but I'm trying to show something that, you know, in the realism of geopolitics, people's will don't come. But in the Taiwanese case, somehow, you know, the kind of the people have spoken and somehow they changed the situation. After the Sunflower Movement, somehow the American, well anyway, the geopolitical balance of power changed in East Asia. And somehow now we earned maybe two or three more years. Now we can survive for maybe two or three more years. And we have to wait for Ambassador Chang to work harder to try to find more space for us, okay? I'm just trying to say that, okay, in addition to balance of power in Taiwan, as a small country, the one lesson we learned is that people's will count if you use it, you know, smartly and, you know, on the right occasion, okay? So constantly faced with harsh and cold reality, I harbor no illusion of any kind whatsoever. However, I do firmly believe in history, and history taught us that even trapped in between empires, the weak and the small could still win their freedom, independence, and dignity. Against all odds, with will, intelligence, and patient efforts. My dear Hungarian friends, the story of Taiwan is not a story of glorious chosen people. No, we are not a chosen people. We are a cursed people. Instead, it's a story of a people forced by the situation to be free. The great Petofi Shandor once said, "If born a man, then be a man." Our people understand what Petofi meant perfectly, for we have learned to be human and to be free the hard ways, and we shall never forget how to be free. If born a man, then be a man. With this line of Hungarian verse, I conclude my speech today. Thank you very much for your patience and kindness.
The two crowns, Spanish and Portuguese, was united and the Spanish came. So why do you think that there was any difference between the Spanish rule and the Portuguese rule? Was the Portuguese any better and why?
Oh, okay. I would just answer directly, okay? And I have to explain that, you know, the Portuguese Empire never really, you know, ruled Taiwan. They passed through Taiwan and they saw the island. And they found it very beautiful, so they said Ilha Formosa, meaning the beautiful island, okay? But they never really fought, you know, with the Spanish Empire over Taiwan, okay? But the Spanish Empire did fight with the Dutch Empire. And the Spanish Empire, they came to occupy the northern tip of Taiwan for like 30 years, okay? But they never really, because at the time the Dutch was, you know, they occupied the southern part and the Spanish was on the north, so they didn't really, you know, interact with each other. Okay, so for the Taiwanese people, at the time there was no Taiwanese people. There were indigenous peoples, right? And the Dutch were beginning to introduce Chinese settlers and the laborers from Falun China. So it's the beginning for the formation of a Taiwanese society. You see what I mean? Okay, so this is my brief explanation to your question.
Thank you very much for the talk, it was fascinating. I have two questions, if I might. First of all, I really found it interesting to the way you highlighted Japanization as a process, and I was wondering if you could see any traces of Japanization in Taiwanese society today. So did it have any long-lasting impact on the society? Is there an element that got included in the Taiwanese identity? And secondly, the way you talked about the newcomers dominating the previous groups, it very much reminded me of Arjuna Padurai's theory of fear of small numbers. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but the point is, he talks about how certain regimes sort of go against minorities. So I don't know if it's a sensitive question to ask, but I take my chance. Do you see nation building as a top-down process in Taiwan? And is there an element of sort of, in a subtle way, going against minorities?
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Okay, the second question first. You are very perceptive. Yeah. Today I have been trying to be cold-blooded, to be cool-headed. I've been trying every effort to try to state the empirical fact that, you know, how a nation state came to be formed in Taiwan, right? But as I said, you know, I implied and I hinted several times that it was actually a very bloody process. And of course, you know, not only there are like bloody conflicts between different groups of settlers, actually I think the cruelest part was the violence against the minority, against the indigenous people. So you see, so this is a part of the story, okay? This is a very, very cruel, and but you know, the point is, you know, nobody really, you know, the formation of any nation state necessarily involve violence. At the foundation of all state is violence. I myself, morally, I'm an anarchist. Because I hate violence, especially I hate state violence. I was beaten by the police several times, okay? I was arrested a couple times. Anyway, as a political scientist or historical sociologist, I had acknowledged the formation of a state, you see? So there are two sides to the story. The one side is empirically, okay, Taiwan is already a state. And on the other hand, and we pay a lot of moral price to become a state. So that's why, at this moment, is one good thing coming out of Taiwan as a state is that we are finally a democratic state. Mm-hmm. And we actually, because nowadays the state is being very seriously constrained by the democratic process. And we, as I said, you know, the dominant idea of Taiwanese nation currently is a civic nation, and which defines Taiwanese as a coalition of multiple ethnic groups. And also indigenous group occupy a very important symbolic and moral position. And now, as of now, the government has just passed a legislation trying to conduct a transitional justice project for the original people in Taiwan. So I think this is the least we can do. You see, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, let bygones be bygones, so what's past is past, no. I'm saying that we have already paid a very high moral price to form a country, but actually the country is not formed by any single one, right? It's formed by a very large, you know, macro historical process, right? And now, finally, the people we call Taiwanese, now they begin to have this collective consciousness as a people, right? Now we have to be more conscious about how we were formed, right? And over the years, over the time, how cruel or how bad we behave to our people, right? So that's enough. So you see, we're trying to be good now, okay? So I don't think that, you know, it's very, basically I supported, you know, the self-determination of indigenous people. But the thing is that in Taiwan, you know, they account for only 2%. And it's very difficult, it's a long way for them to really form a political subject and to really succeed in the national liberation movement. This is only the reality. So I think, you know, at least, you know, for a period of time to come, we have to settle with a good country. They were forcibly, you know, they didn't really become Taiwanese on their own will, right? But somehow they were forced to become Taiwanese. But now we are here. We cannot go back. So we have to try to restructure our relationship. So now this is what's going on in Taiwan. And Aboriginal people, indigenous people have become, occupy a very, very large position in Taiwan's current policy. Okay. So this is the second. The first thing, I think you are very perceptive. Are you a historian or social scientist? You are very perceptive. Anyway, you are conversant. Yeah. Anyway, very intelligent. Yeah, you are right. I mean, the kind of assimilation policy is long-lasting, the effect. It's very tricky. It's very hard to really describe. But one crucial aspect, which you can very easily observe the kind of effect, is the Taiwanese view of history. You see, in Taiwan, the mainlander group, they came to Taiwan after 49, and they had a very bitter experience with Japan, right? So many of them, they came to Taiwan with very negative impression of Japanese. On the other hand, the so-called native Taiwanese, they were ruled and influenced, deeply shaped by the Japanese, right? And their cultural values and many things, they were influenced. And then, so you see, they had a very different view of history vis-a-vis the mainlanders. So in Taiwan, you see we have different ethnic groups and different settler groups who came to Taiwan at different points of time. So you see, so we came to have different views of history. We don't have a unified and single view of Taiwanese history. So this is the beauty of Taiwan, you see. So that the young people, they want to fight against the government's policy to impose a Chinese nationalist historiography, right? But they don't want a Taiwan-centered Taiwanese nationalist historiography. Instead, they call it civic, a citizen's historiography. They wanted to form, open and pluralistic view of history by way of the negotiation and conversation among civil society. So this is what's going on in Taiwan. So, okay, we have very clear difference between the view of history between different groups. So you see, in Taiwan, mostly Taiwan, and a very easy impression is that Taiwan is probably the most, pro-Japanese country in the world. I think it's on the popular level because, you know, somehow the kind of memories and the values, they pass not through the school education, but through family, the socialization within the family. So, you know, from the older generation to the younger generation, okay? So somehow they had this very vague, but you know, very fond memories of Japan. And it's very hard to change. It's very hard to change. So you see, so we have divided memories. This is a very clear about the effect, and this is totally irrational or irrational. It's not something that you can reason. Even if you say, you know, you tell them that, oh, Japanese did a lot of, you know, bad things during World War II, you know, it never changed the situation that, you know, many Taiwanese people, they love Japan. For some reason, they love sushi. They love onsen, you know, they love hot springs. I don't know why, you know. Okay, so I think this is one of the popular memories, okay, the kind of long-lasting effect of Japanese assimilation, you know. They left a very deep imprint on the Taiwanese popular memory, collective memory of the past.
And does Japan play on that thing?
Pardon?
Does Japan play on that sentiment?
It's very hard to play. No, it's okay. It's okay if you remain unpopular, you know, just daily life level. But if you wanted to capitalize, you mean, for instance, you mean to politicize it, to turn it into political use? Mm-hmm. Are you saying this?
Yes.
Well, I cannot say no. I mean, of course, in the 90s. But it's very difficult because the kind of feeling actually had been suppressed by the KMT for like 40 or 50 years. So you see, during the 90s, when Taiwan began to democratize, and suddenly the kind of suppressed feeling erupted. So I don't know whether it's really a manipulation or it's a natural explosion of something some kind of collective unconsciousness. You see what I mean? Yeah. And but I think that the stage has already passed. Now people become very rational and I think they are much more settled down now. It's easier for them to differentiate between daily life. Okay, it's one thing that I like sushi, and it's different thing that, you know, whether I wanted to agree with Abe's, you know, policy. You see what I mean? I think, you know, people get mature over time, right?
Köszönjük szépen még egyszer a figyelmet!